Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
Hello, everyone. Today we have a very exciting guest, Milena Evans, who is the author of Neferura. This book focuses on Neferura, the daughter of Hatshepsut, as she navigates political turmoil, death, and intrigue. We have romance, we have a tattooed wise woman, which we're going to talk about because I'm really interested, and major Egyptological characters like Thutmose III, Senenmut, Hatshepsut. So this is a must read for any ancient Egyptian lover or any, you know, lover of those retellings that are really popular right now about myths and ancient history. So thank you, Milena, for being here today. And I will say we're going to try not to do any spoilers so we don't ruin anyone's reading of this. We're going to talk more broad, Egyptological character choices, things like this. So first, thank you again for being here. And I know you're also, we'll post your background and bio in the show notes, but you have a PhD in ancient Egyptian history. So can you tell us a little bit about your Egyptological background as well?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I do have a PhD in Egyptian history from the University of Chicago. I mean, I graduated, feels like 100 years ago. I think it was 2011 is when I finished my dissertation, which was about sexed body parts in the representational system.
Awesome.
At the time I was finishing my dissertation, honestly, life challenges were popping up. And I just kind of, even though, of course, you do that because you want to be a professor, I sort of changed tracks at that point. I was becoming a single mom, had two kids. So I didn't quite go that direction. I teach a little bit from time to time, and I write a little bit from time to time. And of course, it's still, you know, a passion. Once you invest that kind of time and energy, I don't think you ever stop, you know, feeling very invested in the culture. So.
Yeah, that's great. So can you speak to a little bit about how you came up with the story? Obviously, I know being Egyptologists, we always are fascinated with what went down between Hatshepsut and Thutmose III. And I think Neferura is a very interesting character because we don't really know too much about her. So I think she's a great vessel, I guess we could say, for exploring this time in Egyptian history. What made you latch onto her when to tell her story?
Yeah, it's funny. I never sat down and thought, who should I write this about? Mm-hmm. Like, she just has been like a traveling companion of mine for years. And I'm not exactly even sure why. But I will say that I think a lot of people have, in one way or another, wondered, what did Hatshepsut think she was up to? You know, did she think she was just so unique, or her circumstances were so unique that she would make the jump from queen regent to co-pharaoh? Or what did she think? She was kind of establishing pathways for other women. And that may seem very modern notion, but I don't know. I think if you're unique in any way, you wonder if other people might follow you. So I don't think that's a totally irrational thing to wonder about. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thought about, what did T3 think of it all? Did he hate Hatshepsut? Did he, you know, were they close? What was that like? Whereas what interests me is, what did Neferura think of all this? I mean, to me, being the daughter of a woman that I believe would have been remarkable even in her own time, mm-hmm. and you're an only child, that in itself is kind of a lot. And as you noted, she's a very silent historical actor. And yes, everybody that lived thousands of years ago, we don't, you know, we can't like peruse their Snapchat or anything. They're all rather quiet, but we know very, very, very little about mm-hmm. her. And so, as you say, kind of a blank slate.
Yeah. So to that point, just to give our listeners, I'm sure they all know the kind of Hatshepsut T3 background, but can we get a little Egyptological here for a second and give some background about Neferura? Obviously, Milena, you know it really well. Kara, you also know it well, really well.
I mean, I feel like it would be to sit on a call with Kara Cooney and explain it a lot.
Yeah. So, Kara, tell us where we are at space-time. What's going on? And then what actual evidence do we have for Neferura? Because as Milena said, we don't have that much.
Yeah. Hello, listeners. I'm lurking here in the background. We're talking about 15th century BCE. And it's an, you know, the 18th dynasty on the upswing, not an 18th dynasty at its height or an 18th dynasty on the downswing. It's an 18th dynasty that's really forming itself. And it's an 18th dynasty that's having a lot of trouble with dynastic succession. The beginning of the 18th dynasty started out with two full brother-sister marriages, we think, that ended with Amenhotep I being childless, or at least not being able to have succession from his own body, which to me indicates that the incest backfired spectacularly. And they had to bring in Thutmose I, who is Hatshepsut's father. And he is almost certainly a relative, a close relative of some kind, but who he is and who he was related to, how, we don't know. So he comes in as king. And we're talking about a time when the incest continues because Hatshepsut marries her half-brother, Thutmose II, and has Nefru Re with that half-brother. And then Thutmose II dies from smallpox or disease. Or if you're reading novels, there could be other reasons involved for the death of Thutmose II, which are very interesting, and I won't give away. But that death creates a succession crisis, and an infant is put on the throne, and Hatshepsut is there as the one who is queen regent, unnamed in anything but God's wife of Amun as ruler of Egypt. And her daughter Nefru-Re, you know, when I was writing my book, The Woman Who Would Be King, I was very clear in saying that Nefru-Re was the hardest character to write about. There's almost no legitimate, unspoiled evidence. All of the evidence is erased. All of the evidence is purposefully erased. So people wanted to disappear this woman. And I mean that, at least in terms of historical terms. I don't know what things were like actually till we get our time machines. We will never know. And we rely on Milena and novelists to help us fill in some of those blanks. But her story is really tough. This was an important woman, right? Almost certainly became God's wife of Amun after her mother and during her mother's co-reign with the child king Thutmose III. But then what else did she get up to? What kind of power did she try to grab? Why was she erased from very, very important monuments? It's yep. all a mystery. Yeah.
Some people argue that she married Thutmose III. But then we know who's the next king after Thutmose III, Amenemhat, who's a different wife's line. So, you know, he chooses if they had children, a secondary son to take over. So what's this? Yeah, the machinations going on here. So yeah, go ahead.
And of course, Thutmose III is not restricted to one wife. There would never be any reason for that. So yeah.
Yeah. So given the fact that you are an Egyptologist and have an Egyptological background, how did that influence the writing of a fictional novel? I can think of a lot of positives, right? You know the background really well. You know really specific niche little things to add in to really build out the world. But were there any detriments to it? Because I can also think of some detriments of being like, oh, how accurate do I have to be? I have to make these stances. I have to make a decision about things that us as Egyptologists are like, maybe, probably, you know, might.
Yes, it's very hard to sort of speak in absolutes, because as scholars, we just don't ever do that. We're like, well, this is possible, or maybe this, or this could have happened. So to kind of plant a flag itself is one challenge. Although that didn't bother me so much, because I never thought like what really happened. This is not a story of what I think really happened. So I could kind of get over that. Staying audience friendly, right? Mm-hmm. Remembering sort of what might interest an audience, language that would not get in the way. Like when I first started writing, I had this idea that, you know, they didn't have the same notions of the brain. And yet we refer to the brain so many different ways, the kind of brain-heart dichotomy we have. Mm-hmm. First, I kind of wanted to be more authentic to the Egyptian worldview. That totally got in the way. Didn't last very long. I was like, oh, I can't write that way. So there were things like that that tripped me up, just kind of how do I keep it so that the audience understands it? But as you say, it was very helpful in terms of people, setting, even the plot, mm-hmm. sort of knowing who I thought the bad guys and the good guys would be. I already had some, you know, bias going into this. because I've kind of reacted to these characters already. And some notions about kind of religion and worldview and the way they saw things. And I did try to embed that in a way that remained audience friendly. So that was kind of the challenge, is how can you put enough in there that it feels like hopefully people learn some stuff about the culture, but is not read like a dissertation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Melina, this is something I'm always struggling with in my popular books because I was talking with Amber about the last one that I was going to write. It was going to be Nojmet. We're moving back to Nefertiti, dear listeners.
Oh.
It's so confusing. But as I was working out Nojmet's story, I'm like, oh my God, I should just write a novel. This is too hard, because you have to actually try to write a nonfiction story that's engaging, that has twists and turns, that identifies characters and identifies moments in time. And it's not easy to do. It's like, you know, there's big debates in Egyptology in particular right now about what kind of hypothetical histories we're even allowed to write. Things that are very much allowed in Americanist histories or even classical Greek and Roman histories that Egyptologists don't allow. And they say you must follow the pharaonic script, so to speak. And if it's not written down, then it's not true. It's a real problem when you're working with an authoritarian regime that would not have written down any sorts of shenanigans
right.
that we know
Absolutely.
People got up to. So
yeah.
how do you account for that? Because we should all be, as Egyptologists, detectives, trying to see behind the machinations of power. We should all of us be that. But how many allow themselves to? How many feel like they're going to get in trouble from the academy and other Egyptologists? It's an issue. It's an issue.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of a creative character. So when I was studying, the other reason I maybe didn't stick in an academic setting was I'm just a creative by nature. And it is hard to figure out where that fits in that structure. I had a great mentor, Jan Johnson. She sort of put a little boundary of protection around me so people didn't come at me too much while I was there. But it's not necessarily easy, I think, for the creatives to figure out how do you do academia in a way that works for your creative notions, but also, you know, is acceptable to your audience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, especially as like a junior scholar, right? Like, to put yourself out there to maybe get harsh critique, or you're trying to kind of lay your claim and find your way through this. And it's, yeah, you don't want to just come out there swinging and everyone just automatically, you know, first impressions do matter. And so it's it's definitely hard to navigate for sure. Yeah. Okay. So I do want to talk a bit about your portrayals of Hatshepsut and Thutmosis III, because I think they're really interesting. Because both characters are very flawed and I wouldn't say are good, right? They're very complex characters. And I was expecting, honestly, Hatshepsut to be portrayed as this like strong, and she is a strong female king, but in like a very like, yay, women, feminism and all this stuff. But that's not how she's portrayed, right? She's filling this gap in power. She's trying to hold on to power in any way possible, right? That's her like sole concern. You could maybe describe her as like selfish. She's not maybe the best mom to Neferu-Ra. Not the best. I don't think we're giving away any spoilers because this is a kind of a known fact, but Senemut's her lover, and that dynamic too, very hidden, right? She doesn't want that to get out. And so why did you choose to represent both Thutmosis III and Hatshepsut in this way?
Yes. So T3 is easy. I don't know. Maybe this is just me, and maybe this is back in academia. I don't like him. I mean, there's like a historic person. Usually you don't really have a strong opinion. We don't know enough to have an opinion. But occasionally you have an emotional reaction, and I will just confess bias. A T3 has just never been he's just always been a little bit like to me. So it was easy for me to kind of make him not great.
Yeah.
I did want to add a little empathy around that, though.
I think your depiction of his childhood, I think, adds some, right. And that the way Hatshepsut treated him throughout his life also, I think, adds to his complexity, and you understand where he's coming from a lot of the times, but also not the nicest guy, but they're both right. playing this court game, right? They're both
absolutely
very astute, willing to do anything to get and keep power. really.
And then there's poor Nefrura stuck in the middle.
And I think, and she comes into the book very naive, right? She's young, kind of not really sure what's going on. All these things are happening that she's finding these secrets. People are keeping things from her. And so part of the book is her growing up and becoming.
Yeah, it is a coming of age story. Yeah. It's a little young. And I agree. I have gotten a little grief from my portrayal of a Chepsu. But I mean, as Kara mentioned today, and I know you guys have talked a bit this on other episodes, this is an authoritarian regime. I wanted to nod to that. So I didn't want to make her just this perfect person. I kind of wanted to show some of the, you know, some of the downside of that, what that might look like. Also, just from a craft perspective and thinking about Nefrura's point of view, like this, the propaganda and so forth theoretically benefits Nefrura, right? She is born to privilege and she has all these abilities. So why would she be at odds with her mother? But if you think about propaganda, it's really just lies, right? And no, I have a daughter and was a daughter. They don't generally like to be lied to by their mother. So from a craft perspective, it sort of opened up a door that would create some schism there that I could kind of advance this, her becoming less naive. The other thing is, I think it's not far-fetched to think of a pharaoh as a narcissist, right? I mean, I've been around narcissists. I have a good sense of what that looks like. So it was easy for me to put on paper. So I really did think of her like as a modern day narcissist. And that kind of drove a lot of the decisions, the lack of boundaries with her daughters, you know, that's kind of on the page. And then in this just very simple way, I just wondered, like, is work-life balance a modern thing, or would they have had that struggle too? Because lots of people can be outstanding at their job and terrible parents.
Yeah.
So that was another notion I had in my mind as I thought about how I would portray her. So listen, I love Hatshepsut, like many Egyptologists. I also have a bias towards her.
Yeah, no, but I think
I did this bad thing to her.
No, but I think Kara would agree with you too, in that people always hold her up as this like feminist icon.
Right.
And like she wasn't trying to change women's rights in ancient Egypt or something, right? Like she saw a moment to seize power. Women holding the power for men is a normal thing in ancient Egypt. She wasn't parading through the streets protesting for women and like changing things radically.
It's a tough thing either when you're fictionalizing or writing nonfiction, but you're trying to come at the character of someone. And I think we've all read Egyptological nonfiction, academic nonfiction, which attempts to place Hatshepsut into this position of savior and idealizes her in turn from what a third wave feminist perspective. And that's just as problematic. So understanding that people of the ancient world were human and had all of their flaws and all of their issues, I think is definitely the way to go. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I liked your portrayal of her. I thought it was funny that you made her like, if we take Zahi's claim that one mummy is her, that she was a little overweight, aging, had her tooth infection, you know, like this imperfect form, but then we're looking at these statues of her perfected and things like this. So I appreciated the little nods to certain things like that.
Yeah, that's exactly why I did those things too. You put you really caught me out there.
I was like, certain things I was like, this is for the Egyptologists in the room. So one of your major characters, which I love, and I think Egyptologists, Egyptian lovers and non-Egyptian lovers will love too, is the tattooed wise woman.
Yeah.
Can you speak to, I think I know why you included her, but can you speak to why you chose to include this character? And after that, we'll get into actual tattooed women in ancient Egypt themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that was a secondary consideration. But I mean, originally, I actually set out thinking I was writing a book about friendship, but I didn't want to write about like emotional friendship so much like all the practical ways friendship helps you through life, like the very kind of tactical, practical aspect. But pretty soon that really turned into a book about kind of power, and particularly soft power, and the different ways women are efficacious in the world. So she's sort of my just barely mystical enough to work around the patriarchy in some way that isn't really defined, but seems like it's efficacious. So I had that in my mind as a good wise woman character from the jump. And I was writing when I ran across the information about the tattooed mummy wise woman from Daryl Medina. Mm-hmm. She really inspired that. Of course, in my book, the tattoos are described as if, you know, the tattoo artist just won tattoo wars or something. Not where Egyptian tattoos looked like. Yeah. So I took some liberties there. But that mummy had a lot of Hathor related tattoos. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And thus I named my wise woman Hathor. I do also think, as you kind of alluded to, the idea of women with tattoos in ancient Egypt has a historiographically challenging past. So I like to kind of revisit that in a more positive way.
Yeah, no, I really appreciated her. And I liked, she was a badass. And so like her popping up and having her spies, her scorpions everywhere were really, it was cool to see. That. And well, I'm going to skip ahead in my questions now because you talked about women and soft power. So I think one of the major themes of the novel is soft forms of power, right? Women working behind the scenes, working within this patriarchal system to subvert it, and the power of female friendships. And so, as we just talked about, I think Egypt gets a reputation for being in the ancient world for being a place that is better for women. Which I think we can agree amongst, you know, Greece or other places, it was a little better, but still not obviously great. And I think you do a really good job of showing the realities of this, right? That Hatshepsut sitting there trying to keep power. She knows she's a woman. People are judging her. So, and I can think of that one scene where they're looking at her statues and she's showing herself more masculine. And right. Neferu is like, why are you doing this, right? So there's a discussion about like, how do you show yourself and pleasing the nobles, keeping the elite happy so you don't lose power. So all this different soft forms of power that women in the past and today have to engage in. Can you speak a little bit more to this?
Yeah, I will say that, you know, there are some ways in which I think early 18th dynasty women resonate a little bit with modern women in the sense that they seem to be able to own their own money. They can divorce and marry. Like they have rights that... And one thing I hoped readers would get is women have gained and lost rights many, many times. Like having legal rights doesn't mean you're going to keep legal rights. So we maybe should be a little less confident in what we have gained and more aware that that can unravel on us. One of the paths I think about in life and put in the book was this notion of solidarity, as you say, right? One way to advance is by sticking together. But yeah, as you note, Hatshepsut does have to show herself as a man in depictions because she may have the power, right? She has the title, she has the power, but she has all these additional considerations. She can't have a harem, right? If Senenmut is her lover, then he's not her husband. We don't, you know, he can't be like many other women who have ruled in time. In patriarchy, power runs through women to men. So if you want to hold on to that power so that it's not falling away from you, and you know, there has to be some way you bound yourself up. And I reference that. She has to fit expectations and tradition and history. And even if you have kind of the legal position, all those other things are still challenges that a man in that position would not have had. So I wanted to point to that. The other thing I was kind of playing with, I think, was notions of bodily autonomy. As a princess, Neferura does not have bodily autonomy. She doesn't get to make a lot of decisions about what she does. And there's a lot of talk in the book about power. And I think it poses a question. If you don't have power over your own body, like, are you really equal? Do you have freedom? Do you have power? What does that really mean? And that's not a new thing that we're just facing right now. This is a challenge women through history have faced. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to put that in the story as well.
Yeah. No, I think that's it. I think it resonates with me with what's going on, you know, right now in the United States. I think it really resonated to me. And I mean, I don't know if there's any solace to be taken that like women have been battling with this for time immemorial.
It's kind of depressing in a way.
Yeah, it's a little depressing, but I think, you know, positives to take from. And I think, as you said, like, the power of female friendships and that we can work together to get things done, just like Neferu Ra does in the book with all of her girlfriends and male allies as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think that's a really nice thing. So one of my favorite parts of the book, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but all the inclusion of little idioms and little tiny elements of Egyptian culture that I think only an Egyptologist would know, being so embedded within ancient Egyptian culture for so many years doing your PhD. And so I really like those little nods, and I think they really helped build out the world a lot and made the world feel really real. And so little things like writing letters in the typical way of addressing someone in a letter, I was like, ha ha, like we've all read those late Ramesside letters or something like this. And so how did yep. you incorporate them? Because I feel like it could feel forced, right? Like you were just trying to like plug in place like, oh, Deir al-Medina here and right. things like that there and going to the tombs and having certain things or temple ritual. Or yeah. like Hatshepsut's Red Chapel makes a little
right.
appearance, a little things like this. And so how did you incorporate all these very niche Egyptological things, but it made it feel really fluid and not forced?
Yeah, you're trying to make it immersive without being heavy-handed, and that is very hard. There are plenty of times I put things on paper and was like, nope, I have to take that. Like, side note, I actually have issues with the tutor for Senenmut. I did that with air quotes, listeners, because I actually think he's a wet nurse. Is the Mina Nisu, I think, is more accurately read as wet nurse. That word means wet nurse in any other area. He keeps the breast determinative. A lot of these great images of he and Neferu actually, I think, resonate with mother-child imagery and nursing imagery even. So, You know, for a minute, I was like, do I touch that? No, you know, there's no way to explain that. just a modern reader. So there were a lot of things I pulled back on. But I just looked for, I didn't want to keep her in the palace. And I guess this gets to the heart of the problem, is that there are the things you know, right? Names, building monuments, that kind of stuff. There's the things you'll never know, right? Relationships, emotions, the storytelling aspects. The part where I struggled were the things you just weren't sure if you should know or should include. Mm-hmm. So as a scholar, you look at a god's wife and you might ask, like, what did they do? And you're looking at the Red Chapel and you're like, okay, they execrate enemies and they pour libations for the god and so forth. Mm-hmm. But as a storyteller, it's a different set of questions. Where does she do that? Right? Mm-hmm. Does she go to the temple every day? Does she have a temple in her bedroom? Is it somewhere on the palace court? And if you decide she goes to the temple, which I did to answer your question, because I didn't want the whole book set in the palace. So part of it, let's get her out. How can we get her out of the palace? So because that's the only reason I have her going to the temple every day. But then you have to figure out, how does she get to the temple? Like, how does she go there? Mm-hmm. The palace on the east bank or is it on the west bank? Don't really know. If it's on the West Bank and the temple's on the East Bank, does she take the royal barge to work every morning? Does she have her own little boat? Who goes with her? There are like all these questions we don't know anything about that you just have to make up an answer to move the story forward. So when I was in a setting, I tried to make it as authentic as possible. And then I just gave myself permission to make up all the other stuff. And hope somehow it came together in a way that had enough real ancient Egyptian in there, but also wasn't, too much for an audience to kind of follow and understand, because you already have the difficult language. You know, the names are hard, the words are hard. You're already kind of challenging your reader just with things you can't get rid of.
Yeah. Well, on that note, can you speak a little bit to your research process? How did you write? Like, what was your writing and process?
Okay. Yes, I did the opposite of probably what any historical fiction writer does, because most historical fiction writers are writers who are picking a time and character and so forth. I was more like a historian trying to figure out how to write a book. Mm-hmm. So in order to not make it sound like a dissertation, I did zero research originally. I just jumped in. And in fact, after my first draft, the first thing I took care of was kind of pick up your book. And okay, what did, what do I need to go back and revisit? For the research, I do things like pick a museum book off the shelf and flip through and be like, oh, that's a lovely necklace. Let's make this mm-hmm. necklace.
Yeah.
Or that's a cool cup. Let's have a jet to hold this cup. So some of it was just like plugging in artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, you get to this, like I have Sheta in the, they're drinking that, which I believe shows up in the Amarna period.
Yep.
In my mind, that's close enough, you know?
Yeah, they had wine.
Just because we know it was there then doesn't mean it wasn't also there a little earlier. So I gave myself a little wiggle room around some of these things.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's really hard to decide what how much research to do on a project. I have this same problem, and how much of other people's work to read. And sometimes I just put things out of my mind and try to blur my eyes to literature so that I can have my own perspective. And then you include it after your initial reconnaissance or survey is done. And then you go back and you're like, oh, okay, so I differ here or there. But it helps you to go in without a preconceived fear or a preconceived bias. It helps you mm-hmm. to be braver in many ways.
Right. I think to your point of like being creative, right? If you read too much, I feel like it might stifle creativity because you're sitting there going like, oh, I know this and I know that.
And don't worry about what the Egyptologists think. The very first paragraph of the book is her thinking about the devourer eating her heart.
Yep.
And it was a really lovely paragraph, but it wasn't exactly, it didn't have all those hemming and hawing. So I went back and added like, maybe this happens, maybe that. And I kind of watered it down. And I wished I wouldn't have because it read prettier originally. But I was like, oh, Egyptologists will call me out on that. I don't do that in my very first paragraph.
We are all of us afraid of Egyptologists.
All of us. Sorry. I'm sorry. I wouldn't worry about them. Yeah. Well, I want to ask if you're working on anything else. Are you continuing the trend of historic fiction?
I am right now working on an Isis retelling.
Ooh.
So I'm hoping that gets launched into the world. And I'm playing around with an Ankh-Sempa-Aten story.
Uh-huh. That'd be a good one.
And I think Amos and Nefertari is somebody who I would like to tell a story for, too. So those are kind of the projects. But on my deck right now is Isis, which has a different set of problems, but it's a little like writing Hathor. Hathor was by far the funnest character to write because, you know, you can just do anything.
Yeah. She's not based off someone kind of real.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. It's been, and also just mature, confident, just a fun voice to write. So anyway, fingers crossed.
I love a good mythological retelling. Those are always really fun. And I feel like popular right now, actually.
Yeah. So many. And it's amazing no one's done Isis.
But they're all Greece, Rome. There's not a lot like outside of classical spheres, I feel like. So I think Isis is long overdue. Yeah. Hathor would be goddess Hathor would be a cool one too.
Yeah.
Sekhmet. I can think of so many.
Yeah, you just have to be careful it doesn't go gods of Egypt.
Yes. Well, I'm not too concerned.
We don't want a Gerard Butler this, you know.
Yeah. Well, I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day. This was really fun. I really enjoyed the book. It's available wherever books are sold. Lana was really great and gave us a nice copy. So I'm very happy to have it. I'm going to pass it along to my friends. So we'll do some book sharing. And the cover is really beautiful, too.
It's a gorgeous cover. I love it.
I'm always a sucker for a pretty cover.
The publisher has been amazing. And thank you guys so much for having me. This was so much fun. I listened to this show, so it's exciting for me to come, you know, be on it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So this is
Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack Ancient Now at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week, and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for at Kara Cooney. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.